First speaker is Kostas Kanaris. Kostas is a PICU consultant and retrieval specialist.
In
the Northwest. You might also know him from his hashtag Friday Quiz on Twitter. And if he's not in PICU or in the back of an ambulance, you can be found playing Disney princesses with his two girls. So welcome, Kostas.
I've got the clicker.
Clicker's on there.
Hi, thanks for coming. So this session is an interactive one because that's how my brain functions. I'm not very good at didactic teaching. And it's based on a real case, a six-year-old girl called Chloe. I have full consent from Chloe's family and their blessing, in fact, to share her story with you and improve everyone's learning from it. Please use the polls to interact with me, and let's get started. So Chloe, you get a call at 6 in the afternoon in your ED department. You're all getting ready to get home. And the advanced paramedic team call you to say that Chloe is a previously fit and well six-year-old girl who's had a history of febrile convulsions. On the way out of her GP practice, she's had a seizure, and on the way down, she's banged her head on the pavement. They've been with her for 40 minutes and they've been unable to control the seizure. They're a very clever bunch of paramedics. They've been reading their CLIPS trial. So they've given a lot of buccal midaz, two lots of IV benzos, and given some Keppra as well. A minute after the call is received, she lands in your ED department. Her SATs are 87% in 15 litres of oxygen through a non-rebreathe mask. Her respirator is hard to ascertain because she's fitting. Her heart rate is 180. Her blood pressure is 62 over 42. Now she's 6. Her GCS is 5. Her capillary refill time is 5 to 6. She's very hot to touch and her temperature is 41 degrees. A very keen nurse hands you this gas. Just take a second to digest this. Now, this is her actual gas. So this is a severe mixed acidosis. She's got a high base deficit, a pH of 6.7, which isn't great. It could be better, doc. I'm not going to lie, says the matron. Her lactate is 5.2. Her blood sugar, that's BM for the non-Brits amongst us, is 8.2. She's hyponatremic and hyperkalemic, and her calcium could be better too. Now, our plan in emergency medicine and intensive care is to try and outsmart the illness in front of us. So if you see patterns evolving long enough, you become better at it. But we need to outsmart the illness while stabilizing this child fast and effectively by reducing harm to her in order to take her to a PICU, which I'm sure you will all agree is where she needs to be. Okay? So what's our best airway plan? Okay, so we've gone all the way to the 40-minute mark for the status epilepticus algorithm. So what does the status epilepticus algorithm say in terms of choice of drug for RSI to terminate seizures in adult or child, for that matter? Thiopentone. Okay, and what do our friendly anaesthetists often pair thiopentone with? What paralytic agent do they often use? Thioend? Sucks. Okay. Right. So would thiopentone be a good choice to intubate Chloe with? So thiopentone is a potent vasodilator. What the APLS does not tell us is that it's not a good match for every clinical situation where you have status epilepticus. Now, Chloe went into it with a sore throat. That's a big clue in the history as to what sort of sepsis she has. On balance, she's likely to have Strep A, toxin releasing. Okay, it's very rare that you see such a severe mixed acidosis in status epilepticus when there's no underlying worrying illness. Okay, so if you give thiopentone to Chloe, she's likely to drop her blood pressure and possibly, if not probably, arrest. Okay, Succinomethonium. What's the one of the commonest side effects of succinomethonium? I heard mutterings of potassium. Okay. So it does cause an increased potassium release. Okay. So we're already hyperkalemic. The hyperkalemia is likely to be because of rhabdomyolysis and acute kidney injury because of a sepsis. She can't clear her own potassium. So we're likely, again, to cause her more trouble to Chloe. So we'll try and avoid succinomethonium. What's your best tube to choose? Would you use an uncuffed tube or a cuffed tube? Try again, think ahead of the illness. What are the likely problems we're going to encounter? Pardon? Yeah, cuffed. Cuffed is the right answer. Now, cuffed tubes can get us out of trouble. It's important our first tube to be the best tube we can have. Okay? We do not want to expose Chloe to the risk of having to reintubate her because we cannot ventilate her because she needs such high ventilator requirements. Why is she going to need higher ventilator requirements? Because she's likely to need lots of fluid. She's going to get pulmonary edema from us. She's got capillary leak. She's likely to be coagulopathic, and it is not improbable that she might even have a pulmonary bleed because she's so coagulopathic. So make life easier for yourselves. Make life safe for Chloe. So cuff tube using rocuronium, 1 mg/kg, ketamine, 1 mg/kg is by far the least cardio unstable plan you could do. And I use the term cardio stable because anything we give her will give you a bit of instability. Okay. Some people might choose to give some fentanyl on top, 1 μg/kg. 1 to 1 to 1. 3 drugs I swear by in most eventualities in PICU. So again, try and beat the illness. I've already given you some clues as to how difficult ventilation will be for Chloe. So the options on there was to ventilate with a PEEP of 30 over 10 or 30 over 5. Okay. So in PICU, we tend to be a bit less PEEP phobic than do neonatal medicine. We're quite happy with PEEPs of 10. And I'll tell you, I've tried PEEP of up to 15 with Chloe to try an oxygenator. Her alveoli are full of fluid, full of blood, and you need a higher PEEP to keep them stented and open. Just imagine the alveolus is like your typical party balloon. The hardest part of reinflating a party balloon is the beginning when it's entirely flat, isn't it? So if you let the PEEP be 5, that alveolus will be collapsing and trying to reopen, collapsing, trying to reopen with every breathing cycle. So have your PEEP higher. You need that to compensate for the pulmonary edema and the bleed. Okay? And if it doesn't work, try going up. 12, 13, 14, 15 is probably my ceiling. Okay? She had a quite long eye time. Again, most of the oxygenation happens during the inspiratory cycle, so we need those alveoli stented as long as possible during inspiration to try and oxygenate. So an eye time of 1.2 is on the high side, so that's what we went for to try and oxygenate her. She was on 100% oxygen and still saturating in the high 70s, low 80s, and there was lots of blood coming out of her T-tube. Now, there's very little evidence to tell us what we should do when there's lots of blood coming out of her T-tube. So the little evidence we have tells us that nebulized tranexamic acid can work in children and in adults, mostly in circumstances of hemoptysis or post-tonsillectomy. The dose for children is 250 milligrams nebulized for the under 25 kilo category and 500 milligrams for those over 25 kilos. And adrenaline nebs vasoconstrict, so in theory should stop any vascular bleed you have. So that's what we did. But we were still struggling to oxygenate her, so we had the option to use nitric. Now, hands up, who would use nitric in Chloe? Hands up, who wouldn't use nitric in Chloe? Okay, so we did not use nitric in Chloe. So nitric is used for ARDS to decrease pulmonary pressures and vasodilate. Our feeling was on balance, if we vasodilated Chloe, she would bleed more and cause further cardiovascular instability. So we steered well clear of nitric. Okay, so first of all, do no harm. Which brings us next to our cardiovascular plan. Ah, no one's using saline. Brilliant. Okay, good. I like that. So standard textbooks will tell us resuscitate with normal saline, or as we call it in PICU, abnormal saline. Now, chloride is a killer. There's lots of papers to prove that. Chloride causes hyperchloremic acidosis, and our myocardium does not work very well in extreme pHs. So Chloe came in with a pH of 6.7. We start loading her with chloride, that myocardium is not going to be very happy. Again, think ahead of the illness. So a balanced solution like Plasmolite or Hartmann's is the least harmful thing to do at the first instance. But we know she's likely to have dilutional anemia. We know she will be coagulopathy. So think ahead of the game. I have a very low threshold of activating major hemorrhage protocol in these children. I need useful volume. Start believing in the term useful volume. Use blood products, use FFP, use platelet, plus or minus cryoprecipitate if you need it. Okay, and that's exactly what we did. She had a total of 260 mL per kilo of volume before we left. Most of that was blood products. 40 per kilo was balanced solution, and I think she had 10 per kilo of saline before we got there. The inotrope choice is a moot one, and that really should come mostly from your ICU team or your retrieval team. The purist will say that she needs NORAD and vasopressin, and well done for choosing that. We have a slide prepared, which Seb will tweet at the end of the session, as to what the choices of inotropes are and what we should use in warm versus cold shock. She clearly had warm shock. We need to vasoconstrict her. The best vasoconstrictors we have are NORAD and vasopressin. I can tell you she was on all four inotropes before we left, plus hydrocortisone. Okay. Hydrocortisone is automatically triggered that you need to think about and give it after you are on the two inotrope mark. Now, it's important to think about cardiovascular instability during intubation. It's best practice to have peripheral running inotrope before you intubate. Our current regional guidelines say dopamine. That's not the purest drug you can give. There's a drive for us to change that to adrenaline. It doesn't really matter which one you use. Use either or it will save your patient. The trick that gets me out of the hole every single time if I land in it is dilute the resuscitation dose of adrenaline into a 10 ml syringe with normal saline or abnormal saline. Okay, I push it in 1 ml aliquots, so 10% of the resus dose each time, and give it a good flush. That looks after the heart rate and the blood pressure, which is something atropine doesn't do, and keeps my patient stable, and it keeps me, and more importantly, my nursing staff happy. Okay, use that trick. Which then brings us to disability. Now, it was becoming by this point abundantly clear that the only thing that would change, that would save Chloe, she was on pressures of 35 on 15, oxygen demand of 100%, and the SATs were in the high 70s. What's the only realistic means of survival for Chloe? I'll give you a clue. Ariane will speak about it at the end. ECMO. Speak to your ECMO center early, okay? The ECMO center demands that for her to be eligible for ECMO, we need to do a CT head first, okay? That was not a happy trip to scan, I tell you. It was quite hairy. But we need to do the basics right. So neuroprotect your patient, keep them at 30 degree angle, bring down the temperature, slow down the metabolic demand of the brain, keep her sugars normal, keep her blood pressure high normal if possible, and keep your CO2 between 4.5 and 5 kilopascals. So we tried to do all those things, and we stayed well clear of propofol. Propofol vasodilates, and in the state she was in, she was likely to get secondary propofol infusion syndrome with a higher lactate, again causing pH problems. So do not use propofol in critically ill children. Okay? We used morphine and midazolam as a background. Midazolam worked beautifully as an anti-epileptic, and we CT'd her head because she bumped her head on the pavement. Thankfully, she did not have any intracranial mischief, therefore she was eligible for ECMO. exposure, antibiotic. So it's declaring itself slowly as strep A toxic shock. What's our best antibiotic choice? Have a think. So we would all invariably give a cephalosporin. I'm not fussy. Ceftriaxone, ceftriaxone, whatever floats your boat. Clindamycin is important if you're thinking you've got toxic shock. Think about it early, give it early. You need to mop up those toxins. But if you're into multi-inotropic support territory, 2, 3, 4, 5 inotropes, if you include hydrocortisone, you need to mop up those toxins better. IVIG can do that trick. Now, there's mixed evidence in the literature, but a Cochrane review from 2013 says it does make a difference. And indeed, in Chloe, it made a big difference. So think about IVIG early. Know about the processes in your hospital, how to get hold of it. It's expensive. It's closely guarded, so you need to sell it to the gatekeepers, but it's worth thinking of. So we gave cephalosporin, clindamycin, and IVIG to Chloe before she left, and we gave all those things quite early on, apart from the IVIG, which she had before we left. Okay. She was hand-ventilated to the nearest ECMO center. It took us 7 days to take her off the circuit. She came off on Boxing Day 2017, and she survived this. She needed aggressive neurorehabilitation for the next 18 months or so. And this is Chloe, last month, riding a unicorn on her 8th birthday. Now, there's two things I'd like you to take from this session. I did not save Chloe's life. I did not put Chloe in that unicorn. The critical care team did not put Chloe in that unicorn. We all put Chloe in that unicorn. From Rory, the porter, who legged it to transfusion umpteen number of times to get the blood products, to Margaret, the consultant pediatrician, who had to fight a battle of epic proportions with the gatekeepers of IVIG so they could let go of the precious drug, to Anne, the senior sister in ED, who stayed with the family, updating them every step of the way. They saved Chloe's life. We are a complex and wide team in healthcare. Make sure the cog works well by asking for help early, and that includes your critical care transport team, and by delegating with precision, with politeness, and by using people's names. Using people's names is important. Names matter. Names make people feel part of the team, and it empowers them. It is quite possibly the simplest quality improvement method you will take with you to everyday clinical practice. The second point I'd like you to take is this. You may go home after that shift when Chloe came in and think, I've had a really rubbish shift today. It's been awful. But just for a second, put yourselves in Chloe's parents' shoes, watching your worst nightmare unfold before you. Now, if you were a parent, how would you like to be treated in that situation? You're responsible to go and update the family every 15 minutes or so. If you're not doing it, make sure someone senior in your team, be it a nurse or a clinician, touches base with the family every 15 minutes to keep them updated, to explain why it's happening, what is happening, and offer them a glass of water. I guarantee you, I promise you, they will not remember whether you chose dopamine over adrenaline, but they will remember if you've been kind to them, if you've been courteous, and if you've been humane. And if there's three things you should all be in healthcare, it's kind, courteous, and humane. Thank you very much.